We are reading, Lainey's going to kick off from 2 Samuel chapter 1. You can see the page numbers up there. And then Shani will also read from Matthew chapter 20. So you might want to get a finger in there so you're ready with that. Just the briefest of reminders of where we're at, going from one book to the next. But as I've said, the division is fairly arbitrary. It really flows straight into 2 Samuel. We saw last week in chapter 31, the Lord strike down King Saul. Finally, after all of the trouble, all the grief that he's been giving to David, that he's inflicted on him, now Saul has come to an end. How's David going to respond? Many human ways we think he could respond, or we might respond to that. Well, let's see how he does. 2 Samuel chapter 1. Thank you.
Chapter 1. After the death of Samuel, when David had returned from striking down the Amalekites, David remained 2 days in Ziklag. And on the third day, behold, a man came from Saul's camp, and with his clothes torn and dirt on his head. And when he came to David, he fell to the ground and paid homage. David said to him, "Where do you come from?" And he said to him, "I have escaped from the camp of Israel." And David said to him, "How did it go? Tell me." And he answered, "The people fled from the battle, and also many of the people have fallen of the dead. And Saul and his son Jonathan are also dead." Then David said to the young man who told him, "How do you know that Saul and his son Jonathan are dead?" And the young man who told him said, "By chance, I happened to be on the Mount Gilboa, and there was Saul leaning on his spear, and behold, the chariots and the horsemen were close upon him. And when he looked behind him, he saw me and called to me, and I answered, 'Here I am.' And he said to me, 'Who are you?' And I answered, 'I am the Amalekite.' And he said to me, 'Stand beside me and kill me, for anguish has seized me, and yet my life still lingers.' So I stood behind him and killed him, because I was sure that he could not live after he had fallen. And I took the crown that was on his head and the armlet that was on his arm, and I have brought them here to my lord." Then David took hold of his clothes and tore them, and so did all the men who were with him. And they mourned and wept and fasted till evening for Saul and for Jonathan, his son, and for all the people of the Lord, and for the house of Israel, because they had fallen by the sword. And David said to the young man who told him, "Where did you come from?" And the man answered, "I am the son of the sojourner, the Amalekite." And David said to him, "How is it that you are not afraid to put your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed?" Then David called to the young man and said, "Go, execute him." And he struck him down, and he died. And David said to him, "Your blood be on your head, for your own mouth has testified against you. I have killed the Lord's anointed."
David's lament for Saul and Jonathan. And David lamented with this lamentation over Saul and Jonathan his son. And he said it should be taught to the people of Judah. "Behold, it is written in the book of Jashar." He said, "Your glory, O Israel, is slain on your high places. How the mighty have fallen. Tell it not in Gath. Publish it not in the streets of Ashkelon, lest the daughters of the Philistines rejoice, lest the daughters of the uncircumcised exult. You mountains of Gilboa, let there be no dew or rain upon you, nor fields of offerings. For there the shield of the mighty was defiled, the shield of Saul not anointed with oil. From the blood of the slain, from the fat of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan turned not back, and the sword of Saul returned not empty. Saul and Jonathan, beloved and lovely, in life and in death they were not divided. They were swifter than eagles, they were stronger than lions. You daughters of Israel, weep over Saul, who clothed you luxuriously in scarlet, who put ornaments of gold on your apparel. How the mighty have fallen in the midst of the battle. Jonathan lies slain on your high places. I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. Very pleasant have you been to me. Your love to me was extraordinary, surpassing the love of women. How the mighty have fallen, and the weapons of war perished." Now moving to Matthew chapter 20, verses 20 to 28. A mother's request. Then the mother of the sons of Zebedee came up to him with her sons, and kneeling before him, she asked him for something. And he said to her, "What do you want?" She said to him, "Say that these two sons of mine are to sit, one at your right hand and one at your left in your kingdom." Jesus answered, "You do not know what you are asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I am to drink?" They said to him, "We are able." He said to them, "You will drink my cup, but to sit at my right hand and at my left is not mine to grant, but it is for those for whom it has been prepared by my Father." And when the 10 heard it, they were indignant at the two brothers. But Jesus called them to him and said, "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. It shall not be so among you, but whoever would be great among you must be your servant, and whoever would be the first among you must be your slave, even as the Son of Man came not to be served but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many."
Please keep 2 Samuel chapter 1 open in front of you. Is the clicker working now, do we think? Yeah? Thank you, Brad. Just one thing as well about tonight, as we look at everyday theology, looking at the Bible. If you're relatively new to church life, or even if you've grown up in church life, actually, you'll notice that everything that we do is built on the Bible, the words that we sing. The most important time of our gathered time together is when we open the Bible and we look at it. And sometimes, you know, that's the foundation for everything that we do. But I wonder if anybody asked you, well, why do Christians always bang on about the Bible? Why the Bible? What if I don't accept the authority of the Bible? What would you say? And actually, I think as Christians, sometimes we stand on the foundation of the Bible without ever looking down and realizing just how precious and solid a foundation we have. So I'd really urge you to come along tonight if you can, or tune in if you really can't make it, and just remind yourself of the precious gift of what the Bible really is. Because everything we do is built on that foundation, and we can so easily forget just how precious a thing it is. So I'd urge you to come along tonight as Tim helps us to explore that, or tune in if you can't. I think it's a really important thing to do as a church, to remind ourselves of that. But as we come to 2 Samuel, thinking about David having waited so long for the crown to come to him, it's always hardest to wait when the thing you're waiting for is really close, isn't it? Think about when you're on the motorway and you need a toilet, but you know you're not going to be able to stop for a while. You can lock into a little bit of a "I've got to hold it in" kind of energy, and you can go for a while. But then when the car pulls into the service station, the vibe shifts, doesn't it? I mean, I'm just speaking about what I see in my kids, obviously, not. If you're hungry, but you know food is going to be a while, then you'd be like, okay, it's going to be worth the wait. But I mean, what I always used to do when I was a kid, I used to drive my mum insane. 10 minutes before the food is ready, that's when I come wandering into the kitchen and start picking. Because when it's really close, that's when it's hardest to wait. Or if you've had a physical injury, a knee injury, something like that, for example, and you get to the point where you can move around without pain, but you know you're still healing, that's when you really want to go for it. I feel fine, but I know I've got to wait. The recovery is close, but you've got to be patient. It's when it's really close that it is hardest to be really patient. And yet, in our passage today, we see a remarkable patience in David. Not everything he does is perfect, but I think his desires are in the right place in our passage today. What we see in our passage summary, this is how I'm summarizing it. Rather than selfishly celebrating Saul's death, David here mourns and then judges the one who proudly claims to have killed him. That's kind of, broadly speaking, what happens. It's not always smooth sailing with David. We're going to see that. But what we see here is we see a desire, a remarkable lack of desire, actually, for him to grab the kingdom. It's coming available. He doesn't just reach and grab it at the first opportunity. And in David, in that instinct, we're going to see a reminder of God's anointed. It reminds us that even with the crown literally in his hand, God's anointed waits for the Father to give him his throne at the appointed time. What we're going to see over the next couple of chapters is it's going to be a real season of opportunity for people. That's always what happens when one government falls. When that seat is vacated, the seat of power is gone, there's a mad scrabble. It's a season of opportunity. Who might be able to get in there? And over the next couple of chapters, we're going to see that. And in the midst of that, David is going to not be grabbing quite the same way everybody else does. But as we go through the passage this morning, the first thing we're going to see is a report. The report of Saul's death reaching David. After defeating the Amalekites and saving all his people and all of his stuff, David goes back to Ziklag. And verse 3, we see that 2 days later, 3 days later rather, a man came from Saul's camp with his clothes torn and dirt on his head. And when he came to David, he fell to the ground and paid homage. People would have known straight away, got back to Ziklag, have a few days recovery, getting everything settled back into place, and then this lone runner comes. And everybody would have known straight away that this guy was not carrying good news. He's got ripped clothes, he's got dust on his head. You know, today you know it's good news if a TV crew pulls up outside your house and someone steps out with a giant check. That's probably good news. There's a signal already here with this guy as he writes it, it's bad news. And everybody knows that the Philistine-Israelite battle would have been happening at some point. The two things are happening. Down the south, David against the Amalekites. Up the north, Saul and Israel against the Philistines. And somebody comes running now and you know that's not good news. It takes about 3 days to run from Mount Gilboa, or to walk fast from Mount Gilboa to Ziklag. So it's likely this guy has come, like literally just come from the battlefield and has been traveling in the intervening time. The guy is let in. He comes straight to David and he bows down before him. David is the focus here. David is the guy he wants to see. And David asks this question, verse 3, where do you come from? And he said to him, I have escaped from the camp of Israel. And David said to him, how did it go? Tell me. Remember back in chapter 29, David came very close to having to line up against Israel, line up with the Philistine forces. He was spared that, but he knew this battle was coming. And he cares deeply about Israel. How did it go? And the report is devastating for any Israelite to hear. The people fled from the battle, verse 4. And also many of the people have fallen and are dead. So it's not just defeat, it's also mass casualties. The Philistines have won. Back in chapter 31, we saw the people of Israel vacating their cities and their homes and going running in the hills, and the Philistines moving in and taking those towns back, living in them. The Philistines are back with a vengeance. And we don't know how David is responding at this point. As this guy is standing here giving him the report, I think it's likely that he's got a bit of a poker face on, not reacting much. The messenger keeps going. Many of the people have fallen and are dead, and Saul and his son Jonathan are also dead. We're going to find out how David feels about this later on. I think for now he's keeping a pretty tight lid on his emotions. And he asks, how do you know? How do you know that Saul and his Jonathan are dead? And just thinking about the messenger's report, having seen what we saw in 1 Samuel chapter 31, what he's saying is pretty true, doesn't he? We can compare it to 1 Samuel 31 and we can kind of track it against that. What's it kind of say? David doesn't know any of this. This is the first time David is hearing any of it. He's just been told about Israel's defeat and Saul's death and Jonathan's death. So he asks, how do you know? The messenger continues, verse 6. By chance, I happened to be on Mount Gilboa, and there was Saul leaning on his spear, and behold, the chariots and the horsemen were close upon him. And when he looked behind him, he saw me and called to me. And I answered, here I am. And he said to me, who are you? I answered him, I am an Amalekite. And he said to me, stand beside me and kill me, for anguish has seized me, and yet my life still lingers. So I stood beside him and killed him, because I was sure that he could not live after he had fallen. At this point, his story starts to get a little bit wobbly, doesn't it? There's a few details in there that don't quite match up. He probably was there. He probably did see what happened. Probably was either part of it or close enough to see what happened. And he certainly was close enough to get to Saul's body before the Philistines came and took it away. But we know from 1 Samuel 31 that he wasn't the one that killed Saul. Saul killed himself. Saul fell on his own sword and killed himself. Saul did ask for someone else to kill him, his armor bearer, but that didn't actually happen. The armor bearer refused. Saul killed himself, and then the armor bearer afterwards killed himself as well. So what is this guy doing here? As he says some half-truths here, but inserts himself into the story. Well, I think what he's doing is he was there at the battle and he saw what happened and he saw an opportunity. He saw an opportunity for himself. With Saul dead and a change of ruler in the offing, there's a chance for him to get on the David bandwagon right at the beginning, right at the start. To jump from being a random foot soldier to being the right hand man to the king, the one who brings him the crown. The one who kind of is that good news bringer for David. He seems to want to present himself here as the one who got rid of David's greatest enemy. As he does that, he's trying to be careful about it. I think he knows about David's reputation. David himself spared Saul the second time around in a very public way. So I think people would have known that David spared Saul in this kind of way. So he does sort of hold back a little bit from it making too dramatic. You know, he doesn't come in and say, and then he swung and I swung and then he doesn't do that. Rather, verse 10, he says that, you know, he asked me and I killed him and I did it out of kindness, verse 10, because I was sure that he could not live. Verse 10, I took the crown that was on his head and the armlet was on his arm and I brought them here to my lord. There it is. There they are. The king is dead. Long live the king. You can imagine this guy's excitement. It's a long journey south. He's making that slow trudge, carrying the armlet and the crown, these two emblems of authority, and he gets to be the one to give it to the new king. You know, what do I say? When do I say it? Do I walk in with it? Do I kind of surprise? How do I? He comes straight to David. And he presents it. Here is the opportunity for David. Here is the crown that he was told way, way, way back he would get. Here is the enemy who has chased him down for so many years and sought his death, gone, out of the way. And this guy wants to be the one to jump right on the bandwagon alongside. Be right there, the right-hand man. We read Matthew chapter 20 earlier. We saw the request of the mother of James and John. It's right as Jesus is approaching Jerusalem. Jesus is about to go to Jerusalem where, as far as they're concerned, he's going to get that crown. And that request comes in right there because they think Jesus is about to be the guy and we want to be right beside him when he becomes the guy, when he becomes the king. Please can we sit at the right and the left of your throne? There's an opportunism. Grab the status, grab the power when it's close. He's been given an opportunity, he's going to grab it. But he's really, really miscalculated, hasn't he? And we really see that as we start to see the response from David. First of all, notice there's no interest in the crown from David. There's no interest in the armlet. Those signs of Saul's authority that are literally there before him, I don't know whether he took them and put them to the side, whether he held them and didn't register, or whether he just held his hands back. We don't know. But there's an offer, but there's no acceptance registered. Rather, David tears his clothes in mourning, and all his men do the same thing. I think we're supposed to see there's a togetherness in their emotional response to the news. I don't think it's the kind of men waiting for a cue watching David. Is he sad? Happy? Sad? Okay, no. I think there's a togetherness here. They say, it says in verse 12 that they mourned and they wept. They fasted for the rest of the day, and it isn't just because of the defeat of Israel. It is also for Saul and for Jonathan. For the house of Israel, because they had fallen by the sword. As much as Saul had been such a source of pain for David for so many years, this is still really awful news. And it's interesting, though, isn't it, to see Saul being mourned by David in this way, because I think we've read so much of Saul's persecution of David over the weeks, and we've seen it again and again and again, and it's vicious, and it's unjustified, and it's unfair, and we've seen the pain of David in those situations. So why does David now do this? I think we should remember that actually at the heart, at the very beginning, Saul and David are family. I think there is actually a real bond between them at the beginning, because when you see David, so the two times when he has an opportunity to strike Saul down, he speaks a lot about who are you listening to that you should be turned against me like this? Who is it that is telling you stories? Who is it that's kind of made you do this? I've done nothing. I think right at the heart, actually the baseline feeling between the two is one of affection. I think it makes it all the more tragic that it's got to this point. I think also David has got to the point where he can afford to remember Saul a little bit more fondly at this point. He's quite well established. He has his own militia. He has his own kind of family with him. He has stuff with him. He has his own victories over the Amalekites. He's relatively, you know, he's not out of the woods entirely, but he's in a much more safe, secure, independent position than he was not long ago. I think all of these things combine and they're intermingled with sorrow for the sake of Israel, definitely sorrow for the sake of Jonathan. But notice that in all of this, nowhere is there any celebration. Nowhere is there any sense of, I asked God to judge and he's judged and now I'm... Nowhere. It's pain for the suffering of his people. It's pain for the loss of the close friend and pain for the loss of Saul. I wonder what the messenger did at this point. Having carried that crown, that armlet, having expected things to go a certain way, and suddenly David and all his friends are mourning and grieving, and suddenly he just sort of is holding this crown and this armlet and thinking, I'll just leave these here for a minute, shall I? Maybe he's assuming that later on there'll be a, you know, once they get over it moment. That doesn't come. David summons him in verse 13 and he asks him, where do you come from? The language is a little bit tricky in verse 13, but basically when it says David sent to the young man who told him, the emphasis is that there was a young man who came and told him the report. What this young man said, what this young man told, everything hangs on that. His testimony, what he said, what his words were. David comes and says to the man who had told him what he told him, where do you come from? He wants to find out more about this guy. What does this guy know? What's his story? And the man tells him that he is son of an Amalekite sojourner. That means he's of Amalekite descent, but he's been born and raised in Israel. So he lives with the Israelite people. He's familiar with the Israelite customs, the Israelite law, even though his kind of heritage is Amalekite. He's sufficiently Israelite, basically, to know how you treat God's anointed, to know what the Israelite practices are. Because then look at what David's question is to him afterwards. A question I don't think he expected to hear, but is justified given what he knows of Israel. How is it that you were not afraid to put out your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed? David himself was afraid to do it. David himself was in a situation twice when he could have put his hand out against the Lord's anointed, but God was the one who put that man in that position, and he was not the one to strike out. How is it that you weren't afraid? David calls then one of the young men and says, go, execute him. And look at what he says, your blood be on your own head, for your own mouth has testified against you, saying, I have killed the Lord's anointed. The narrator really wants us to see that it's this guy's words that bring him to this end. The testimony he brings, you've testified, and so the blood is on your own head. We're going to think a little bit about whether David is right to judge here, but I think there is a little bit of a reminder here, just to the danger of half-truths. I think we can all be quite easy to say something that's really explicitly lies, I wouldn't. You know, I don't want to lie. But when it's like 80% truth, but we just add an extra 20% that suits us, that is lying. That is dishonesty as well. I think sometimes you want to kind of have grades, and we think, well, I wouldn't do this, but this. I think there's just a little bit of a warning here, and a reminder that truth really matters. As Jesus says, let your yes be yes, let your no be no. If you're following a God of truth and you follow a Lord Jesus who is nothing but truth, try, pray to be someone of absolute truth in your life. And when it suits you to be one way or another, that's when we have the greatest temptation to just tweak a little 5%, a little change. Pray for God's help to make you someone who is of truth, nothing but the truth. We don't know what the messenger does at this point as David lays this charge against him. We don't know whether he says, I was lying, I didn't really do it. We don't know. What is clear is that the messenger saw an opportunity to grab for glory, and all he ended up grabbing was death. I think the fact that David interrogates him in verse 13 is trying to figure out whether this guy acted in ignorance or not. Whether he had the information available to him to sort of think, no, this is wrong, but I'm going to do it anyway, or whether he had no idea. I think if this guy, you know, had acted in ignorance, it might have been a completely different thing if he was a complete stranger, but this guy has no excuse. In terms of David's judgment here, I think his heart is in the right place. We're going to see that in a moment. But he does ultimately kill an innocent man, doesn't he? And what a precious reminder in our seed thought earlier that God is the perfect judge. Because in our time now, you can have good intentions. You can try to want to honor God. You can try to want to do the right thing. But you don't always have the information available to you. And you can mess up. And even the godliest people, the best judges of our land, the best rulers of our land, are capable of miscarriages of justice. It might be that David here wants to do the right thing, but ends up doing something that is not commendable. I don't know what you think. I'd be interested to hear afterwards. But honestly, I think David's heart is in the right place. He twice had the opportunity to strike God's anointed, and he had offers of help. People around him saying, I'll do it for you. You don't have to get your hands dirty. Back in chapter 26, he says, do not destroy him. Talking about Saul. For who can put out his hand against the Lord's anointed and be guiltless? And here comes someone saying, I put my hand out against the Lord's anointed. And then David says, well, you're guilty. It is only God who will judge when it comes to the anointed king of Israel. And the king gets to judge, by the way. So David has the authority to carry out this sentence. Back in chapter 8, when the Israelites ask for a king, they want someone who's going to do two things. Judge us, fight our battles. And so we see David doing part of that, and we've seen him doing lots of the fighting and the battles. But when it comes to the anointed one, only God can remove the one who he has appointed for the task. Only God. David really feels that. David really, really knows that. And I think to hear someone just talk casually about striking down God's anointed would have been shocking to him. David knows his place before God in this passage. It's interesting in Matthew 20 when those disciples make that request to be at Jesus' right hand as he kind of takes the throne. Jesus says this to them, speaking of the fact that it is not his to give that honor. It is not mine to grant, but it is for those for whom it has been prepared by my Father. The anointed King Jesus is one who wants to serve the Father first. And when others around are kind of jostling for power, as he rises up, he says, none of this is for me to decide. It's for God to decide. He is the ultimate authority. There are some things that only God decides. And to override that, to step on that for the sake of your own ambition, is to deliberately dishonor God. And so in this passage, as a contrast, the messenger is trying to grab for himself, conscious maybe of what would be honoring to God, but not conscious enough for it to change anything that he does. Directly dishonoring, directly disobeying God. You've got the messenger on one side, grabbing for status, opportunism. And on the other side, you've got David with a perfect opportunity to grab. And no. He wants to act in a way that upholds God's honor. And so what we see here is grief for his people, grief for his friend, grief for his king. And seeking to uphold God's honor, God's timing, God's choice. There's no selfish celebration. He feels the weight of this moment for Israel. He feels the weight of losing a close friend. He feels the horror of hearing someone boasting about killing God's anointed. So David's response is not necessarily what you might expect. But then he goes further. Because in the last bit of the section, we have a remembrance. The books of Samuel haven't made a lot of mention of David's songs. Even though we know he wrote songs, we've got whole, you know, psalms and psalms and psalms of David's songs. Here we get another song. Of course, the last song we had was Hannah's song, the beginning of 1 Samuel chapter 2. This song isn't so theologically prophetic. It's a very different tone. It's a song of lament. It's a sad song. In this remembrance, what's David trying to do? It seems that he's trying to be quite deliberate in reclaiming the death of Saul and Jonathan from the Philistines' narrative. We know from the end of 1 Samuel actually the dark reality of what happened to Saul and Jonathan. As this song is sung and written, Saul's head is still fixed in the temple of Dagon in Philistine territory. His body probably is buried by now, and in the next chapter we're going to see David really honor those people that went and took and sort of saved Saul and Jonathan's bodies. But we know the dark reality of what actually happened to Saul. The shame of it. The brutality of it. And I think David seems to want to make sure that that enduring memory of these two is one that is positive. So there is a bunch of poetic license, but that also tells us a little bit about how we understand these verses. It's not often that we see a song in the Bible and we know what actually the events kind of match up to. It's quite helpful to see that, isn't it? Look at verse 17 to 18. David lamented with his lamentation over Saul and Jonathan his son. And he said it should be taught to the people of Judah. Behold, it is written in the book of Jashar. So David is leading the people in this. It's not him scurrying off to a corner and writing a little thing and strumming on his acoustic guitar, just a personal thing. This is written for the public, for Israel, to have a remembrance of Saul that is a particular one. Some of the descriptions that we might see here might seem out of keeping with what the actual actions are. But I think what David's desire is should jump out here. Rather than trying to look at this and be like, hold on, that didn't really happen. Hold on, this is real poetic license. Look at what David's wanting to do here. Think of what reason he has to sing like a horrible kind of breakup song kind of vibe talking about Saul. That horrible guy, oh, he's down now. And, you know, you get some psalms that can be have a bit of a vibe like that. But notice what he wants to do. He really wants to honor the memory of Saul and Jonathan. And he really wants to lead the nation in grieving. Think about all the kind of, there's going to be a lot of vengeance to come. A lot of vengeance to come. Think about if David had written a song that was like, yeah, vengeance is great. How that might have affected things. You look at this song that he writes. First of all, he seems to want to kind of reclaim the narrative from what the Philistines might have had. There's this verses 19 to 20 is marked by this feeling of pain that the Philistines should be rejoicing over this news. That use of the word uncircumcised. It carries a sense of the false gods that the Philistines follow. Dagon, Baal. Over in Philistia, they're celebrating that Baal is the real god, that Dagon is the real god. They're the ones worth following, and that's a painful thing because David knows who the real god is. Verse 21 speaks of Mount Gilboa, and it kind of gives this picture of it being cursed from now on because it is the site where this thing took place. That Saul's shield, not anointed with oil, is a picture of a shield that's fallen into disuse. You would anoint your shield with oil, kind of treat it, to condition it, to keep it in good condition. Here it is left to the side. It is all cracked and it is all broken. That shield that stood up for Israel in a flawed way, but did stand up for Israel in battle, now lying to the side. Verses 22, 23, 24 seem to be summarizing Saul and Jonathan and showing that they were a blessing to Israel, and that they fought for Israel, and they offered a shield for Israel against their enemies. In life and death, they were not divided, verse 23. They were swifter than eagles, they were stronger than lions. Think once more about Jonathan, and how remarkable it is, after all of the fights and all of the disagreements, that Jonathan was sufficiently loyal to his father that he died alongside him at this point. Saul was brutal to Jonathan at times, and Jonathan's heart was for David's kingdom to flourish. But look at this loyalty towards his father, fighting alongside him right to the last moments. David doesn't want to celebrate the fact that father and son were at each other. He wants to celebrate the fact that they died together. I think that's an amazingly commendable thing to do. When we want to celebrate the division, when we want to celebrate the things that separate, did you know he didn't really like him, and da-da-da-da-da-da-da, they died together. They were there together right till the last. Verse 24 speaks of Saul's reign as being a time of blessing to Israel, and this might be the thing we think, oh, that's real poetic license. This imagery, it is imagery of fine clothes and ornaments. It's language of wealth and prosperity, and we might think back, was Saul really like this? Was he really such a blessing to the people of Israel? I mean, you know, he was the one who chopped down all the Jewish priests in cold blood a few chapters back and all these kind of things. But I think we should zoom out and remember that Saul was a significant defender of Israel against the Philistines. Before Saul came onto the scene, the Philistines ruled. They destroyed all the blacksmiths everywhere in Israel. The people of Israel were powerless, basically. And although it was a really flawed thing, Right back at the beginning, God did say, I'm going to use Saul to save my people from the Philistines. Saul didn't finish the job, but he was a significant factor in Israel being able to fight back now. There was a stand that was made thanks to Saul. And I think it's testament to God's grace that Saul should have still been a blessing to Israel, even with all the nonsense, even with all the mess. This was still God's choice, and God still did use it for good, even though we've been exploring all the messiness of it. From verse 26 onwards, Jonathan comes into view, and the tone is much more personal, isn't it? I think Saul is described in kind of, lots of kings could have been described in that way. When it comes to Jonathan, there's a personal connection. Jonathan is a beloved brother. Someone who is fiercely loyal to David, someone who is a kindred spirit in terms of his attitude towards God. There's a personal pain here. And we know from the story, Jonathan always had David's back. Key moments when David was really vulnerable, really down. Jonathan was the one that God used to lift him up. This kind of effusive language of love between brothers in arms, it's culturally, at the time, pretty common. I think as we read it, we have to just remember it is possible, believe it or not, for two men to have a really powerful bond without there being any romantic suggestions. I think we should remember that because so much of the language of affection between men has been coloured by how our culture has developed it. To the point where we read it and we read it with a modern lens and we forget intellectually just how shallow that is. What are the first readers? How do they see it? How does the writer see it? I think it's so important that men feel they can be really good close friends. Don't let our society take that from us. It's so important. These guys were brothers. And also, David has a messy relationship with women. We're going to see that. But these guys were such close brothers. And Jonathan's respect and love for David was remarkable and astonishingly commendable. Notice again, for all of the reasons that David might have to celebrate Saul's death and celebrate Jonathan's death as the kind of heir to Saul's kingdom, David does not celebrate Saul's death. He celebrates Saul's life. He speaks of how God used him to be a blessing to Israel. Rather than selfishly celebrating Saul's death, David mourns and judges, maybe imperfectly, but he judges the one who proudly claims to have killed him. And so that's what we see in this passage. And it reminds us of the fact that God's anointed is one who waits for the Father to give him the crown. One who waits for God's plan to come to its full fruition before he starts to say, it's mine. In Matthew chapter 20, Jesus says that it's not for him to appoint people to the seats of honor beside him. And as he does that, he makes this challenge to his followers. Think about this for the disciples that think, oh, there's about to be a significant vibe shift. There's going to be Jesus on the throne, and we're going to be right beside, right hand, left hand, right there with him. And Jesus says this to them, whoever would be great among you must be your servant. And whoever would be first among you must be your slave. Even as the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. A king who grabs will want his followers to be grabbers. A king who is wanting to get it for himself and get it for himself and get it for himself will want his followers to be the ones that get it for him. Bring it to me. Bring. But a king who gives and serves wants his followers to give and serve like him. What kind of king do we follow? A king that grabs for power. A king that comes to this world with power like nobody has ever had and said, bow down to me before, right now, you don't know who I am. I'm going to show you who I am. Is that the king we follow? We have a king who comes into this world and is more truth-filled and more authoritative and more powerful than any human being in the entirety of human history. And he comes and he gives everything of himself to save lost rebels. And he will have the crown. But he waits for when the Father gives it to him. And if we follow that king, we are not to be people that grab, that are opportunists, that are always looking for, when can I get some status? When can I, oh, it's close, I'm just going to, No. We seek first the kingdom. We make ourselves servants because we follow a servant king. The Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. A king who grabs wants his followers to grab too. And the world will give us nothing but grabby kings. And the world will encourage us to be nothing but grabby people. But a king who comes and serves wants his followers to serve like him, love like him, give like him. In Christ, we don't have to worry about the seats by the throne. We don't have to worry about the future. It is not ours to build. It is not ours to grab. It is given to us as a free gift through faith in Christ. If you're a Christian here this morning, your future is not in jeopardy. You can rest assured with all of the drama going on in the news, with all of the difficulties of work, with all of the temptations to grab. Your future is not in jeopardy. Your place beside the king is secure. It's not going anywhere. And so with the life that you have now, the time that you have now, live like the servant king. Follow behind the one who gives and gives and gives. And know that our king will, in God's time, be given his eternal throne. Let's pray. Father, we thank you that we have this king that is anointed by you and yet not full of his own power in a way to just grab, grab, grab. Rather, he is a giving, loving, self-sacrificing king. We simply pray that you would help us to not be like the world in this area, but be like Jesus. We pray in his name. Amen.